With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. And joining me now for Media Matters is Marty Gibson from the Papadopoulos. How's the Papadopoulos today, my friend?
It's a little, you know, it's not its usual New Zealand's Florida, beautiful blue sky, but, you know, my garden's happy for that.
It's a little autumnal here today.
It's a little bit of a chill in the air. I notice as walking the kids to the bus at 7 in the morning, the sun's not quite rising, so despite all the flapping about February being the hottest on record, if NIWA ignores all the weather data that doesn't fit with the narrative.
Oh, I know. And, I mean, gosh, it's snowstorms in California, but, I mean, let's not split that here, shall we? Anyway, hey, we've got a lot to talk about this week. Let's kick off with I don't know how much time we want to spend on this, but let's kick off with Luxon and Premier House. We both sort of had the same feeling on this. I mean, in a way, this story's been jumped on and leaped all over because I think they're all recovering from the News Hub bombshell, which we'll get to later on. But I have to admit, I look at this and I just see, for me, it's like, wow, really? Really?
Yeah, this it's a real take care of the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves philosophy on financial management.
And Christopher Luxon made some really, really rookie mistakes. He's made, you can tell he's not a seasoned politician.
He shouldn't have said, I'm entitled to the entitlements. That was a mistake.
Yes, and he shouldn't have flip-flopped on the decision is the other thing he shouldn't have done.
Yeah, I mean, he could have just said, you know, we're in government to make law. I'm acting within the law. Perhaps we need to change the law.
Or I would have even been calling them out saying, look, you're focusing on this as an issue. Why aren't you focusing on our education numbers? Why aren't you focusing on this? Why aren't you focusing on this? And actually whack those points out and then just battered this away for the nonsense that it was. And of course, you and I both discussed this. The weekend papers were full of it. The opinion columns were full of it. Everybody has had something to say about it.
Small's take was that his spin doctors and more media-savvy colleagues must have wept into their lattes, saying you are entitled to a taxpayer-funded perk is kryptonite to any politician, especially cloth cap-wearing socialists with dandruff on their poorly fitting tweed jackets, Vernon.
And of course, Vernon didn't mention the 20 Labour MPs that all claim exactly the same allowance for properties that they actually themselves own, and they are the tenants thereof.
Yeah, what I would say, though, is, you know, this is a predictable consequence of having a corporate guy who is adept at donning corporate persona in that role, because if you interact with those corporate types who may be psychopaths in 16% of cases as opposed to the 1% background in the general population, they are obliged to return a profit to the shareholders. And morality is an indulgence unless they can use it for social media clout, in which case you do it as cheaply as astroturfingly possible. Mm. That was a landmine with a flag on it that said landmines, and he totally must have thought it was the hole at the end of the third.
Exactly. At the end of the drive.
Yeah, he just puffed straight for it.
Yeah. It's woke 101, Chris. Chris, if you're listening, woke 101.
Firstly, I hate you because you're rich for a start.
Yes, you were never going to get a free ride. And I know that in your lived experience, you would like to think that you're tapped in. You're tapped in with that team. You're not, dude. You're not.
I hate you.
Yeah, with a passion. And sit down with Winston. He'll have a whiskey because I understand you're a teetotaler, but you have yourself a good cup of Darjeeling with Winston and get him to school you on, if that sort of question comes at you again, because it will, the deflection that you need to do, because it's a it's an absolute nonsense. And of course, no one, I mean, there was an article in terms of the work that needs to be there, and then people saying, well, tell us how it's unlivable. Well, it's actually unlivable because as the Labor government, you spent a lot of time and money putting in a healthy home standard, of which you then forced hundreds of thousands of New Zealand homeowners and rental homeowners to enforce in their own homes that other people have to live in, that they need to meet, that you're not even meeting in our premier residence for our prime minister. So let's not split that here, shall we? You know?
Yeah, and I mean, the media is saying, well, we've asked, I think the Herald was saying, we've asked them for pictures and the report into the house, you know, but they won't give it to us. If they publish that, it's going to be news all around the world. Mm. This is New Zealand's premier house where the Prime Minister is, and it looks like, as Grant Robertson said, a motel room with 1980s decor. Probably the guiding light, as always, in the newspaper on this was Bruce Cottrell, wasn't it, yeah. In terms of just his basic echoing our, well, you know, not. I think it's easy enough to see our reaction generally to seeing Grant Robertson or Chris Hipkins on the TV. It's just like, just go away. You're like an arsonist that's complaining about how the fire service are putting out the fire that you've started, attended by a herd of squealing pigs bewailing the empty troughs to get a bit Kiwi Farm on you there.
Yeah.
Because no, I know you like that.
No, I do. I do.
You love
it. I
do good,
like that. Yeah. I do like a little bit of good Kiwi Farm. Yeah, and he also too covered the embarrassment of, which I covered in Kiwi Farm last week, of Ginny Anderson's appalling behaviour towards Mark Mitchell, which was just shocking. And, you know, just a long legacy of poor behaviour and ill discipline amongst a variety of their ilk. And they really have lost their way. And I look, all political parties do. I mean, let's face it, National has been, you know, trying to find its way back from the weeds for a long time. And Labor has now found themselves there again. And, yeah, Cottrell does cover that absolutely beautifully. But, you know, from my perspective, all of this is just a massive distraction from the things that are quite important and what should be covered. So, and one of those things is education. Of course, the NCEA results came out, and then there was the report on how well the kids did in NCEA. And shock, horror, it is hardly surprising that our kids are failing. They are failing at high school. So just to give you an idea, so these provisional results that came out for last year's achievement, so this is 2023 compared to 2022, 60% of Year 11 students achieving Level 1 is down from 64.9% in 2022. So 60% down from 64.9, so 5% down, so 5% less from, and it was already piss poor, let's face it, in 2022. Year 12 students was essentially 75% in 2022, now 72.2. And level 3, 68.2% in 2022, 66.2. However, UE, so of course I'm thinking, me and my dumb mother mind is thinking, oh, level 3 is like seventh form and that's what you use for university entrance. No. So you have NCEA level 3 credits that you can earn in subjects that have no bearing whatsoever in order to obtain a university entrance. You actually have certain subjects which those credits are also deemed university entrance credits. I only just discovered this year. So right. When it comes to university entrance, in 2022, 50% of year 13s, so only half of them, got enough credits for UE. This, so for 2022 exam year, for 2023 exam year, it dropped to 47.2.
Mm.
So less than half of those year 13 kids have obtained enough credits to actually see them go to university.
Probably a blessing in disguise for them. They should be going out and building a log cabin and living on possums and deer.
And yeah, and so that was actually one of the points that then got brought up in a full inside article with our wee friend Derek Chen,
yeah. Derek can't see the wood for the trees.
Yeah. But mind you, Derek still has that magical yep, that's what it is moment. Bless his little heart. He'll go down in immortality for that. I've just finished on this one news article that I've got first before we dive into Derek. Factors contributing to the decline. I always find this interesting, what they believe is the blame, right? The results showed the percentage of students who achieved NCEA qualifications out of the entire student population for each year level. This included students that weren't participating in NCEA or may have left school during the year. Last year, NZQA said there was a trend of some schools not participating in a full Level 1 learning program. Well, we know many of them have opted out and gone to Cambridge or Baccalaureate or what have you. Principals told One News there were many contributing factors to the declines last year, including the impacts of the years of lost classroom time caused by COVID-19 disruption, the impact of attendance declining after COVID-19 disruption, the irregular classroom time caused by teacher strikes in 2023, and some students leaving school to gain employment before the end of year 13. Not once did they say disengagement of students into the curriculum, because when I talk to the kids that come through this house, they're all moaning and groaning about what they're expected to learn and how it doesn't excite them or enlighten them or engage them.
Well, even more, if you talk to kids, they'll sort of say, I know I'm getting lied to.
Mm.
And that's a fatal, fatal thing to do if you're trying to engage teenagers. Once they get a sniff that you're telling them things that you know to be untrue, you're going to really be pushing it uphill to get that trust back. And obviously, it's not coming back for a lot of kids.
And especially for boys. Boys are seeing through the bull a lot more readily than the girls. So, and I mean, there's always been a little bit of a gap between female and male attainment, and actually that gets picked up in this article from Derek. Derek and also to Chris Knox. But it was fascinating. Like when I sort of had a little dive into there. So what the article is, it's in the reviews, Weekend Herald from Saturday. It was personally, other than Bruce Cottrell, the only... that was probably the best thing out of the paper that weekend.
Can you tell me what page it was, Buster?
It was page A14. So it's called While You're Looking for That, Marking Our Schools. The Weekend Herald has crunched the university entrance and NCEA Level 3 data for every high school, and clear patterns emerge, as well as the types of schools that stand out. Derek Chen, head of data journalism. Oh, data journalism, that makes it. Of course you are, Derek. And Chris Knox explains the numbers. I know we josh the Derek, but I do love reading Derek's stuff because he's a numbers man.
It's a rare thing, and we shouldn't.
No, and I love you for it, Derek. I really do. I did actually dispense a lot of highlighter on this because, again, I learned things that I did not know before, including, and I was still, I knew they were getting rid of the old decile system, but I hadn't quite realised what they'd replaced it with. Yeah, right. So, Derek, while you're still looking, Derek starts with, in a perfect egalitarian world, student achievement would have nothing to do with social disadvantage. But an analysis of the latest available data for every high school shows the striking pattern. Good outcomes are strongly correlated with social advantage and poor outcomes with social and economic deprivation. The main finding was a strong link between social privilege and educational success, but a few schools bucked the trend, notably three kura that designed their teaching around the needs of the Māori students. So Derek did supply a table, bless his little heart, and he had the top secondary schools for Level 3 NCEA and then also the top 10 schools for UE. And it was pretty much a muchness between the two schools. According to Derek, the main finding was a strong link between social privilege and educational success, but a few schools bucked the trend. Right, so the top 10 of schools and let's just look at NCEA, Christchurch Adventist School, Manukau Christian School, Dilworth School, One School Global, King's College, Te Kura Māori Ngā Tapuai, Barrowdean College, St. Peter's College Epsom, St. Joseph's Māori Guilds College, and Te Tārangi Rudolf Steiner School rounded out the top 10, which is interesting because I know the Steiners also do baccalaureate. Now, what struck me, and it's the one thing, and I went through this entire article to see if it was going to get mentioned once, and it did not. The other strong exceptionally strong correlation with every single one of these schools in one form or another is faith.
Yeah, values and
values lowbrow. And faith.
A belief in some sort of objective truth.
Yeah, so Christchurch Adventist School, Seven Days Adventist, Manukau Christian School, so that's just Christian. Dilworth, I think, has got an Anglican base. One school global, that's Brethren. King's College, I think, is Anglican. Te Kura Māori, well, Te Kanga Māori. Barrading, Catholic. St. Peter's, I think, is Catholic. St. Joseph's, Catholic.
St. Joseph's is something I associate with Māori achievement because it's...
Yeah, but they do have, and actually there's a brilliant quote from the deputy principal on that a little later in the article, and obviously Steiner at Sophical. So there is a strong moral and ethical code that runs through all of these schools as well.
Mm. And, you know, if you want to look for themes, you know, we could, and we'll talk about the terms of reference of the COVID inquiry later, but I think the education system probably suffers from a similar set of problems that the COVID inquiry does, in that you've got all of these people who have designed the system and championed it and perpetuated it, talking about how to fix it. And really, it's going to take a while, as it does with narcissistic types, to, by a while, I mean, they're never going to do it. They're never going to figure out that Taylor Swift bit of wisdom. It's me. I'm the problem. It's me.
Mm. Yeah, well, you get that when you're marking your own homework, don't you?
Yeah. And what I would love to see is just a real internalization of the terrible, terrible cost of this level of failure on that scale. Failure to engage children. Failure to deliver what you're paid immense amounts of, well, immense proportions of the nation's GDP to deliver, and when you're in a role that's so vital to the future of this country, we've got to really take it much more serious. And I think, you know, for all that Derek's article must have been getting close to 1,500, 2,000 words, it surprised me he didn't talk to the Minister of Education.
No, he got comment from here right at the very end, but no, did not get. Not direct. Yeah. But he did actually have some good little nuggets of stuff that I just was not aware of. And these are some of the things that I love Derek for. So, of course, I knew the decile system they were getting rid of. So that's the old 1 to 10 system. Mm. And, of course, many of our friends in Labour and the like hated it, because what they were then seeing, particularly during the housing crisis, you know, remember that? The housing crisis? Oh, that was so 5 years ago, the housing crisis, is they hated the decile system because it created all these little housing bubbles around the higher decile schools, particularly in Auckland. So they got rid of it. This is what they replaced it with, okay? As indicated by schools' high equity index score. And I'm thinking, what is this high equity index score? Unlike the old decile system, which ranked schools 1 to 10 from poorest to richest, the new EQI increases by deprivation. So I'll say that again. The new EQI increases by deprivation. So scores range from 344 for the least deprived schools to 569 for the worst off.
Mm.
So explain to me again how this differs from the old decile system, other than giving it a nice new woke name, equity. And jumbling the numbers up. It goes on, EQI data uses a combination of factors to judge student equity, such as the parents' income, qualification, and ages of the birth of their first child, along with any criminal record, time spent on a benefit, social welfare interventions for their children, and a number of times a family has moved home.
Isn't it amazing that they don't have the biggest driver of inequality among children in there? The presence of the biological father?
No.
They can't go talking about that. And, you know, that's always funny, isn't it? You know, socialists always say, oh, you're obsessed with money. They're obsessed with money. It's not the money. It's the culture. It's the attitude. It's the valuing of education.
Yeah.
That's what drives that.
And that, my friend, is the secret of the kura kaupapa. Because when they spoke to the kuras, particularly the kura Ngā Tapawai, is that was the one of the things that they said. So they looked at them because they were an outlier, because their the EQI score was high, which means that they have so-called more deprivation. But it's because they had, as a community and a culture within that school, to see those students achieve. So they had a strong sense of self-agency.
Yeah. Well, that same self-agency that gets taken off kids, and it's a shame that they have to do it by, you know, I suspect, often saying the whole world's against you, the system wants you to fail, you know, you've got to fight against our enemy. You know, you could reframe that as, hey, the world has got so much to offer you and you've got so much to offer the world, you know, and if you make that effort, the benefit to the world will be so justifying of that effort. So go get it.
And you know what? That was summed up beautifully by Ash Brown. Ash Brown is a former teacher and deputy principal and currently acting manager of the school hostel for St. Joseph's Māori Girls College here in Napier. So this is what he had to say. And I thought, go Ash Brown. The tikanga of the college enables our students to develop a sense of belonging and identity. Belonging leads to mastery, which in turn leads to success. Discriminatory reasons for underachieving are ignored, and dumbing down is not acceptable. Amen, Ash Brown. He said expectations are not limited by the factors that contribute to EQI values.
Yeah. And he also, and whether it was him or another kura, was saying that if, you know, they have meetings with parents and pupils, and if the parents aren't doing what they need to, they tell them. If the pupils aren't doing what they need to, they'll tell them. And if the school's not doing what they expect, they'll tell them. And so, yeah, again, that agency, that responsibility is kryptonite to your hand-wringing, flabby Pākehā socialist who wants to get on side with Māori by calling them victims at every turn.
Yeah, indeed. There were also some schools that are really struggling. Schools in rural or small areas were among those with the lowest proportion of school leavers with UE. I see your old alma mater was in there, my friend. Lytton High School in Gisborne, 0.8%.
Yeah, I mean.
Now, to put that in context for people, they do have a massively strong gateway program there. So I would say that most of those kids that are at that level are working through that gateway program. So to be.
Well, you know, I mean, during my time working with the Polytech, one of the barriers that they had getting kids more into pathways, you know, like they've got with Gateway, was that one of their core pissing contests was how many kids went to university. And you know, again, that's one of the things where, you know, and I'm not holding out a lot of hope with Robbo joining the rest of the failed Labour politicians at Otago, dragging it presumably worse and worse, deeper and deeper into the woke mud of non-achievement. But again, we've got to have a good look at how fit for purpose universities are. Because unless they want to do something real specific, I'd have a hard time encouraging children, especially boys, to go to university. Oh, and the fact that they don't think it's a problem that 50% more women than men go on to tertiary training is quite revealing. Because if it was the other way around, you can bet that it would be for all sorts of patriarchy reasons. Mm.
Yeah, look, these are the conversations swirling around in this house right now with a year 12 and a year 13. You can imagine.
They need to go and be lumberjacks in the woods and build themselves a log cabin and fight off bears for a bit.
Perhaps. Dr. Nina Hood, who's the Education Hub founder and secondary school teacher, she said that I think part of it has come down to the environment and culture within the school. You think? We know that having a strong sense of belonging is really important for students. My guess is that they have very high expectations, and they're going to have excellent teaching and learning if they're getting that percentage through UE. The other thing to note is that there's a relatively small number of students. That probably makes the difference to the type of learning that they do. And this is in regards to the kura that she's talking about. She then goes on to say, another pattern of note in the data was the relatively good results from integrated schools. So the integrated schools cover a lot of the faith-based schools. So, for example, my boys are at St. John's College, which is a Catholic school here in the Bay. This is not a new trend at all either. You can look at some of the factors and you're seeing with Kura, the strong culture, the strong sense of belonging, the creation of an environment that has a clear set of values associated with it. And it's kind of, it's like faith, but it's like, it's like kryptonite. They do not want to talk about faith any here. Now, I don't carry faith, but I just, having some form of faith is actually a really strong indicator of the culture, the performance that, I mean, and they, it's almost like this, we do not want, don't speak its name, because we don't want to encourage people or to actually give it credit that that is part of the reason why these schools are a success.
Well, it's not just the lack of faith. It's, I mean, teaching kids that, you know, especially young Pākehā kids, that, you know, they are terrible, terrible people by virtue of a blood libel, that their mere existence is killing the earth, which is going to die in a few years anyway, and, you know, because we're into global boiling now, so there's no future really. Why learn trigonometry?
Yeah.
You know, you're just going to boil. That's the difference between a civilization in ascendancy and a civilization that's in danger of imminent collapse, and we're certainly fitting the description of the latter on so many levels, and we urgently need to think, well, how do we not only survive, but have a vision that is clear enough that children feel themselves worthy of survival.
Mm. And it does worry too that these kids, I mean, one thing that kids want to do is they want to have a sense of belonging. They want to be part of, you know, they want to feel important and valued and all of those things. So when you have something like the Kura that brings everything together in terms of that full hapu concept that you are embraced within your family and this is how important you are, and yep, it is literally that rising tide that lifts all of those boats. The problem now in a lot of state schools is that feeling in community is actually coming from the intersectionalists, and that is terrifying.
I don't blame Māori from wanting to cut loose from the culture as it is. What I always caution them is, hey, we don't like it any more than you do. It's our common enemy. If the Kura is working, if I can help, how can I help? Mm-hmm. You know, you go. You don't have to make me your enemy to succeed, because there's a big world out there that we've both got to cooperate to address the impacts from.
Yeah, indeed. In terms of sort of that sort of sense of belonging and central agency, one of the things in the story that's just broken in the last couple of days, which has upset people greatly, has been the sentencing of the young man who bashed Judith Hobson at the Posey Park.
71-year-old Judith Hobson. How old was he? 21, 22?
He was 20 at the time.
20 at the time.
20 at the time.
That's a problem.
That is a problem. That's a huge problem. When I saw it break, I had to sort of step away from it because I just knew I'd lose my shizzle, and that's just not good for my mental health. So I needed to sit on that information for a while and go back with it less emotional. And so what we have is we have this young man who pleaded guilty to the assault charge straight away. He finally went up for his sentencing hearing. And in the sentencing hearing, Judge Kevin Glubb has given the young man a discharge without conviction, which was that application was opposed by the police. But he has gone and given this young man a discharge without conviction on the basis of his 150 hours community service, his neurodiversity in the form of autism and ADHD, and the fact that he showed remorse and he undertook community service and therapy, and he's just been asked to pay $1,000. He left Judith concussed with a black eye. She had head injuries, you know, concussion, head injuries, and around her body and ribs as well. So, you know, she took a fair whack. Her statement when she left the court, I just thought, summed it up beautifully. I'm absolutely livid, she said, that he walked out of court with, in my opinion, virtually no consequences whatsoever. It's no wonder victims don't go to court, because they will become victims all over again.
Mm.
And I look at this and I look at, and this young man to me is a perfect signal of what our high schools and polytechs are producing with this ideological capture by intersectionalists. And when I say intersectionalists, people who believe that identities and the fluidity of gender are vastly more important than actual reality
and
facts.
And also the left, I admonish myself every time I say left. Let's call it what it is. The less freedom, more government faction.
The unconstrained sector of our society.
Yeah, that upward pointing fist means something. It means violence is an acceptable reply to someone being above you on the hierarchy. You punch up. And so if this guy's going to get off, I'd really like to know, I mean, what examination was there of who G'd him up to the extent that he thought it was cool to punch a 71-year-old woman who didn't take action when they saw him getting a bit of hot under the collar to, calm him down a bit.
Well, they said he was around
him. Who drove him up there?
Well, he was a victim of the frenzy, they claimed. All right, then. Who created the frenzy? Chanel?
Yeah.
Darling, where are you on this?
Who was that pathetic creature who threw that particular brick off a motorway overpass and then walked away whistling?
Indeed. And you've got this sort of interesting juxtaposition, right? So he gets permanent name suppression. And I can see how the judge has been thinking on this. The judge is looking at this going, I have this conundrum where I've got this young man who is showing apparent remorse that if he has a conviction against his name and his name is out there, that could permanently damage him for the rest of his life for the action that he has created. Now, the thing is that what about the action, what about Judith? What about the victim in this as well? There has to be some form of action and consequence. He's got off this scot-free, completely scot-free.
Do you know the name of the judge?
Yeah, Kevin Glubb.
No.
The other thing that concerns me is that, with him, with this young man, which is from Gisborne, by the way. So if you and I really put ourselves to it, we could find out who it is. But, there we
can't go. Punch him in the face because I wouldn't get away with it.
No, true.
Not that I'd do it.
No. So here he is with autism and ADHD. And this is what this is. So this is me from my mother of a neurodiverse child at on. This kid, he was 20 at the time that he did this. One of the things that they've already shown is those who are very, very steeped in gender ideology and intersectional behaviour and that whole tribe, is those with neurodiversity are more highly represented in that group than any other group. Okay, they're very susceptible to it, exceptionally susceptible to it.
Just like mothers, the mothers of children with gender dysmorphia tend to be 80%. Cluster B personality disorder.
Exactly. So this young man has been sort of sucked into this. He's found his place and sense of belonging amongst this community that have now essentially whipped him into a frenzy to get him up to that. I mean, he would have travelled up to there to be part of that rally. The thing is that they could have given him permanent name suppression, but a conviction, because I actually think that conviction, having that conviction on his record, that is going to scupper your chances to do a few things, Petal, over the next few years. But you know what? That little itch and a reminder, particularly through your 20s, is actually a little jab saying, don't be a see you next Tuesday, mate. Don't go around poaching grandmas.
Women in the face.
Yeah, just don't do it because it's not socially acceptable.
He's like the how dare you of dudes who want to wear dresses.
Yeah.
What's that Cabbage Patch Kid's name again? How dare you? You've stolen my dreams.
Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, Greta.
Cabbage Patch Kid. Oh, yeah, she kind of does, really, with pigtails. Anyway, I digress. I mean, the whole situation, I know the Free Speech Union are trying to sort of do something around this, but it's another one of those decisions that with the judiciary where everyday people are looking at this going,
if someone was breaking into my house and I punched them in the face, I wouldn't be getting off without name suppression. It's the state's it's the way the state enforces its monopoly on violence.
Mm.
As strange as that is.
Yeah. Hey, I just want to talk quickly about the COVID inquiry, because of course the submissions are open for in terms of those terms of reference. And we had, if you're a member of the Foundation Members Club with us here at RCR, Marty and I were part of the team that had our chat, our Zoom that you get if you're a member, and we had a great conversation. And part of that conversation, Katie Ashley Coppins was there, which was so good to see her. She has been working like an absolute Trojan on this, as well as inquiries and so much work behind the scenes, both here and in Australia where she's based. And there was a really interesting article around, you know, are things set to change? So it seems like some information, some pressure is starting to sort of seep through to the minister in charge of this, which is Brooke Van Velden. Did you see that?
Yeah, no, I've got a fair bit of highlighter on that, actually.
Yeah, I thought you might do. Where do you want us? What jumped out for you on that?
It jumped out at me that the New Zealand Herald has a fortnightly Herald column focused on the public sector and how taxpayers' money is being spent, called the public purse.
I know, I didn't know what that was. Isn't that a new development?
6 years of not giving a crap about how money is being spent particularly, and now they're real worried about it.
That
jumped out at me. But yeah, again, I mean, we've sort of talked about this earlier in the show, didn't we? It's the fox policing the chickens.
Mm.
The key problem of in simply bolting new terms of reference onto the current work is that it leaves in place the last government's choice of chair, epidemiologist Tony Blakely. Blakely is a New Zealander and professor of the University of Melbourne. He is esteemed in his field, and he was the guy driving a lot of Dan Andrews.
Yeah.
Jackbooted shoot protesters with rubber bullets at the war, at the cenotaph. COVID response.
Oh, come on, Marty. Such scepticism to think that he could not look at this with an impartial eye. Really? After being in Victoria? No.
Well, I mean, you know, they've got a vacant chair. Why don't they stick Guy Hatchard in there?
Well, yeah, you know, there would be some balance.
Yeah. Linda Wharton. I'm sure that those of us who from the start were saying, yeah, I don't know about this, you know, could agree on, you know, a single person.
Yeah.
There should be someone, because, I'm not sure. I mean, you had Deborah Chambers KC, who aired her views in the Herald last year. Putting an epidemiologist in charge of this inquiry is like putting a rabbit in charge of the lettuce garden, she wrote.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah, she is absolutely spot
on. The monkey in charge of bananas, as they said on Trailer Park Boys.
Oh, gosh, you and my sons both. Anywho, Jordan Peterson's guilty little pleasure, I'm told. Anywho, because, of course, in this article, they're outlining the difficulty of removing the legal aspect, the difficulty of removing a commissioner from the commission, and then also juxtapose that with the cost of scrapping the commission.
I don't think they should scrap it. And they say the sunk cost of the current inquiry would likely top $10 million before a new one was even conceived. I mean, the problem is outlined at the start in the terms of reference, which is, of course, what
these submissions are for, to set these terms of reference.
Set out what it will and won't cover, should expressly include such matters as vaccine procurement and efficacy, the cost-effectiveness of the government's policies, whether the rules set by the government appropriately balanced COVID elimination with other goals, and whether school children in education got short shrift. So, it should cover those things. And I can imagine why Ashley Bloomfield wouldn't, because I don't remember hearing him talk about any other health concern when he was blinking myopically at the camera during those 1 p.m. podium truth.
Yeah, they batted everything away as if, how dare you speak about these things, delayed cancer treatment, there's a pandemic.
Yeah, there's a possum crossing the road, we must dodge it and go into this river of debt over the cliff.
Yeah, so.
Over the fiscal cliff.
I mean, the release of the contract, there's a start.
Yeah, anyway. How about that? What was the decision-making process not to release health outcomes by vaccine status. You said you were going to, and then you didn't. Why not? Who made the decision? How was the decision made? Would you do it again? You know, that sort of thing. I would welcome Guy Hatchard onto that, what is it, a panel? Board?
Commissioners.
Commission. Matt Sheldon, Linda Wharton.
So just remember that if you are in a, you know, you are wanting to have your say on this, make a submission, do. Put your thoughts together, jot them down, submit something in there.
COVID inquiry. The 24th of March, is it?
Yes, it's the end of the month. COVIDinquiry.co.nz has been set up as a tool to actually help you be able to make your submission a little bit easier and gather your thoughts and pull things together. And it doesn't just have to be about the vaccine. It could be anything. It could be how COVID affected your business. It could be, were you caught up in MIQ? Did you have issues with being able to see a loved one who was caught up in the risk here? And I mean, God, they locked those down tighter than Mount Eden Prison. Were you separated and not able to mourn or care for or console somebody in an emotional or time of grief? Whatever the thing is that really the pandemic and the government's response to the pandemic prevented you from being able to do that has made an impact on your lives, pop that as part of your submission.
And, you know, the other point I made during the webinar was, I mean, everyone knows someone who's lost a loved one or been vaccine injured, normally both. I know, I mean, gosh, I know quite a few people. Do a bit of hand-holding. Get them to make a submission. That's something you can do. Because a lot of them are too tired or just wanting to get on to the extent that they won't, but it really does matter.
It does. It does. And as I said before, COVIDinquiry.co.nz is that website if you are wanting to be able to get some help with or some clarity around your thoughts. There's some really, really good tools
here. I just had a thought, Marie. You know, because being as this is Media Matters, should we talk about the apparent imminent collapse of mainstream media? Is that part of our brief?
It is part of our brief, I believe. Yeah. It is, yeah.
It's brush over the fact that...
I have to admit, a lot of column inches were dedicated to that over the weekend. It's quite an interesting... I actually spoke to someone a couple of days ago that works for another privately owned media company. I was there doing some stuff for my the day job. I know, and these are two people that I know professionally, and I said to them, hey, News Hub, thoughts? And it was really intriguing, like one of the, because we were bouncing stuff backwards and forwards. And one of the things that really amazed me, and this is, you know, around the announcement from Times Warner Discovery, that they are going to be closing the newsroom, or they've signaled that they will be closing the news operations with a loss of around 300 jobs. What amazed me, the thing that struck me, having worked in a private media entity for 5 years, is the fact of the absolute sort of shock and like, oh my gosh, we can't believe this is happening and this is the end of the world and this is a bolt out of the blue and all of those things that they
expressed. We're misunderstood. We really do our best to do a good job.
Now, one of the things that I know, having worked for 5 years, and in that 5 years, I went through four redundancy rounds, and it was at a time in media in this country that was as tumultuous as it is now, so that was in the late 90s. And I said to these two, I said, I don't know about you two, I'm stunned that they are so shocked that this could have happened, because the one thing I learned very quickly is there's nothing settled or stable within media. You can't take that for granted.
Yeah, you might have to make that move to PR sooner than you thought.
Oh, it seemed to work for Jessica, didn't it? Gosh, she landed on her feet, bless her little heart. So, yeah, it is certainly a bolt from the blue. So there's some, I mean, there are some good people, I think, that will be going begging. Michael Mora and Ryan Bridge are two off the top of my head.
My picks too. Michael Mora, especially, I find is a really impressive journalist and comes as close to the normal sort of standards of journalism that you'd...
I thought his coverage of Cyclone Gabrielle was head and shoulders above everybody else's by an absolute country mile. Absolute country mile.
It was interesting reading, and I mean, this kind of formed a bit of a theme as well, reading about TVNZ's rejection of the joint news plan that baffled News Hub. And they just rejected it. They weren't aware that News Hub was about to collapse. This discussion, so this is a comment from TVNZ spokeswoman, said this discussion was preliminary, but would have seen TVNZ take on significant cost and risk of a new service. So we informed Warner Brothers we're not in a position to advance any talks. If it was preliminary, how did she know it would have meant more risk and cost? But that's the problem with state-owned anything, isn't it? Because if you're in a private company and someone makes a proposal, you don't just think, oh, that's risk, I'm going to leave it, because you understand that you need to take risks to make money. If you're getting paid your salary regardless of, well, regardless of the risks you take, you're going to not take risks.
No. And do you think even if they did know, like if the team from Three went there at that meeting and said, look, we're up against the wall here and the firing squad's been loaded. We need to do something to stop them firing.
I don't think they would have.
I think that it wouldn't have changed the outcome.
Should fund a fiercely independent agency that could be a collaboration between government departments, Ministry of Statistics, to basically present really good quality data, which, you know, can then be fashioned by journalists into stories. You know, because, well, you know, journalists are functionally innumerate usually.
Mm.
And I think it would allow better quality journalism and take some of the cost out of it. And it would create a well-informed public that would ultimately be good for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you read, you know, the story of TV3 and you read about all the
near misses,
you know, all the various equity companies that took stakes in it and paid almost $1 billion dollars for Three in the case of one of them, that's why we've got a problem. And I guess if you go up above the clouds with it, you know, as I've said before, these big equity companies are often the first in line below the Federal Reserve, just printing off all this money. They get first crack at it and they get to turn fake money into real assets.
Well, this issue, though, isn't just a New Zealand issue. I mean, News Hub are actually facing and befalling what is now happening with news agencies, privately owned or equity owned news agencies across the Western Hemisphere. I mean, look at CNN. I mean, that's hanging on by the skin of its teeth. All of them are seeing massive drops. I mean, Fox, they were the one outlier that were always traditionally doing very, very well. But then, they caved to pressure and got rid of Tucker Carlson. And they now, I think I saw something reported, a 16% slump in the last reporting season, in this current reporting season. So it's
I pointed out that interview Tucker Carlson did with Mike Benz. And then I was told, to my surprise, and this just shows
how much good content we've got.
Reality Check Radio doing. Apparently, we'd had him on twice.
Yeah,
this guy was just encyclopedic in terms of his understanding of all of this nefarious stuff that these various U.S. governmental expressions of the military-industrial complex have been doing to basically squash democracy and reporting that doesn't fit with their agenda. They see themselves as being democracy, and so they'd viewed all these, you know, that dirty word populist uprisings in various places, and they've implemented all of these systems to censor the internet. The media might be dying in one form, but the control's enduring and solidifying its hold on the human psyche. And we're at the end point. You know, you look at those educational standards, we can still look at it critically because we've known other things. We've got a whole generation that haven't. And there was an interesting show on, I think it was an Australian network, some three-letter thing. I can't remember what it was. But, you know, saying basically people under 40 are people are not becoming less socialist as they get older. There is a line in the sand. They're not. You know, it's so embedded in them, those Marxist principles, that they're just, and we've got this situation where, again, those equity companies a short-circuiting what you'd expect would happen, which is these baby boomers retiring, selling their businesses to the next generation. That's being short-circuited by these private equity companies. They're buying them up.
Mm.
Where the noose is gradually being tightened around us.
Mm. And you can see now the reason why there is such a push for these, you know, what Dear Leader's doing in terms of this Christchurch call and these hate speech laws. And Canada has, you know, they're now moving with theirs. And I think the Irish have now, I think theirs, I don't know whether theirs is passed or it's close to, because they've suddenly realised that linear television or linear media in their traditional legacy forms are now no longer capturing the masses like they used to. People who are seeking alternatives have disseminated across the internet predominantly, looking at alternative sources. So they've been now playing over the last 3 or 4 years this massive game of whack-a-mole. COVID gave them the impotence to be able to do that and shut down and censor people's voices across social media in the, you know, in the name of the pandemic. Well, that's gone.
Well, maybe they wanted to do that and COVID.
Yeah, but that's, but the, well, gosh, Martin, are you, is that a conspiracy theory I hear?
You ever notice that people say, I don't believe in conspiracy theories? It's a way of saying, I don't examine thoughts that might make me uncomfortable. It's not like they look at them and then discount them. They just don't look at anything that's not on the news.
No. So again, I cannot reiterate enough the thanks that we have, and we did it on Sunday night, and I'll reiterate it again, the thanks that we have to, I mean, we exist at the largesse of you, the listeners, and in the, our wonderful Foundation Club members who support us financially, and those that make one-off donations, and some are big and some are small, and just help us stay on the air and give you another view, an alternative and a view, so you can make up your own minds, you know, because this is what it's about. It's not treating you in such a way like a small school child that needs to be told what to thought. I mean, you know what to think, you know, and that's what we're here to do. So we really, really do appreciate that.
You know, how to think is probably a better way to put it, isn't it? Because that's what gives you your opinions is the way you think, and what you think changes accordingly.
Yeah. So it will be very, very interesting to see now what happens, because, of course, Today FM was less than a year ago, and that sort of sent waves through the media landscape, and then things have sort of settled. Now this has happened with News Hub, largely out of the blue, and stuff, you know, I mean, it was in, I think Shane Curry had it in his media insider piece, you know, Stuff are going through a massive redundancy round at the moment within their sports newsroom, and there are, I think, 4 or 5 that will be losing their jobs there. I think that that's just the beginning, just quietly. So this isn't the first time that this is going to happen. And I think that there's going to be a lot of flux in the next couple of years amongst our media landscape.
Mm.
So did you also see the, from Newsroom, Victor Billett, who likes to do a weekly poem on Newsroom, did you see his ode to News Hub?
I did. I was horrified that Paddy Gower was Gandalf the Grey, essentially, and I was presented as a goblin.
Mm.
That seemed all back to front.
It did. It did. So I so that was shared with us as a little group over the weekend, and I took one look at it and read the back end of it and thought, I don't think I quite like the ending of this. So I rewrote it.
This needs some buskeration.
I did. I gave it some buskeration. I gave it a little bit of a, you know, Victor did it in regards to a Lord of the Rings theme, and I thought, well, I'm someone that can rewrite stuff within a theme. So I've rewritten the end of it, and I quickly jotted it down and recorded it and shared it with the team. And I have to say, our wonderful producer Dave did what producer Dave always does, and he sprinkled his sugar on it, and he made it really fantastic. So Marty and I will catch you all again next week. Thank you very much for your time again, Marty, today. It's been good. We've chewed a lot of fat today. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thanks, Marie. And as always, it's a pleasure. And have a good week, everyone.
Yeah. And thank you very much, everyone. Stay tuned. There's still more great content here to come on Reality Check Radio. But I'm going to leave you now with my rewritten, revised version of an ode to NewsHub. So written by Victor Billett and the Buskerator.
An Ode to NewsHub by Bard Billett on the bombing of a broadcast bastion. The revised edition. The new dark age. The icy winds blow through the dim and lost valley of legacy media. The moonlit ruins of a once mighty city lie scattered for miles around. There stand the silent stony statues of the ancient lords of the Fourth Estate, King Mike and Queen Samantha, Earl Ryan of the Hot Take, Lady Melissa Chan Green, and the mighty wizard Gower the Grey. Their proud countenances stare over the eerie piles of rubble. Beyond the crumbling walls of NewsHub lie broken wastes of stuff. Stands in the shattered marble monument of RNZ, gather the cold ashes of TVNZ. Sit the empty cracked ink barrels of the New Zealand Herald. Alas, all is lost. The fortress of public good, the guardians of the democratic spirit, the unbreachable walls of free speech, now all just a misty, half-forgotten legend. Nothing remains. Or does it? In the distance is the sound of drumming and cheering and discourse. There within the Temple of Rivendell, around the pure blood altar of truth, an army of elves and hobbits sing and hoot and worship at the feet of their new priests. Reality Check Radio.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.